The following talk was recorded at LibrePlanet 2021 Empowering Users, the annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. LibrePlanet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libreplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. LibrePlanet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the grievance of all computer users, LibrePlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss, and for more information on LibrePlanet, you can visit libreplanet.org/conference.
Hello everyone, welcome again to Neptune Room. And this talk is titled A Dispatch from the Frontlines of Right to Repair, and it will be presented by Paul Roberts, the founder of Secure Repairs and publisher and editor-in-chief of the news website The Security Ledger. The Security Ledger is an independent security news site that explores the intersection of cybersecurity with the Internet of Things, the precise intersection where free software meets the right to repair physical items. If you haven't already seen it, the FSF has a new campaigns page, an animated video from late 2020 supporting the right to repair, and will continue to report on and support this issue going forward. In his talk, Paul will discuss how his group of over 200 IT and information security professionals are battling against electronics industry claims that allowing the right to repair will undermine customer privacy and security. Apple, Samsung, LG, and General Electric have stomped out several attempts to win the right to repair by claiming that it will enable device hacking, cyber stalking, and identity theft. Paul and his colleagues are here to set the record straight. And Paul, the stage is yours.
Thanks, Özgen. I really appreciate it. And thank you to everybody who's joining us here today at LibrePlanet. You all are passionate about free software, and this is an important issue going forward for the movement and for our future. So thanks for joining me. Thanks for the very nice introduction. I'm going to just start off by telling you a little bit about myself and about Secure Repairs, which is an organization that I started 2 years ago specifically to engage with the right to repair, which is something that is near and dear to my heart. So as you heard, I'm the founder of securerepairs.org, and the URL is right there. And I'm also a longtime journalist, publisher, industry analyst. I founded a publication about 9 years ago called The Security Ledger. And that's generally how I pay the bills, is writing for The Security Ledger and covering the information security, cybersecurity space. So I've been a journalist there for about 20 years. More recently, a repair enthusiast. I started attending kind of fix-it clinics and repair cafes in and around Boston, where I live, and kind of got introduced to some of the people in the movement and some of the issues around the right to repair. And that, I guess, that's sort of the bridge between information security and repair for me, was just that I personally got interested in this kind of fix-it clinic, repair clinic movement. And kind of got introduced to it that way. So Secure Repairs is a group. It's not even a nonprofit group because we don't even have nonprofit status. It's really just kind of an industry group, an affiliation group of people who are in information technology and information security. and who support a digital right to repair. I founded it back in 2019 after talking with Nathan Proctor at USPIRG about that group's efforts to get state-level digital right to repair laws passed and some of the trouble that they were encountering, namely that large electronic device manufacturers, OEMs, were coming in to legislatures and basically sort of waving their hands and saying hack and hacker and cybersecurity. And that was sufficient to scare legislators away from digital right to repair legislation. And I recognize that the arguments that they were making on digital right, you know, on cybersecurity risk related to repair and service were not substantive, that there wasn't really much basis for them. But I realized also that that the information security community didn't speak with one voice on this, that it wasn't an issue that the industry, the folks in the industry I knew had united around, even though I suspected that they would be sympathetic to the digital right to repair movement. And so I basically set up that group. I created it and went out and got more than 200 of the world's top information technology and information security professionals to join on as supporters. That includes folks like Bruce Schneier, noted author and serial entrepreneur, author of the Schneier blog, former NSA cryptographer, John Callis, also co-founder of PGP, former product security chief at Apple, Gary McGraw, author of Secure Software, Tara Wheeler, who's most recently been at the ACLU, Avi Rubin, teacher at Johns Hopkins, and on and on and on. We've got a lot. Joe Grand of Grand Design Studios. And it's an impressive list. You can check it out at securerepairs.org and click on the Who We Are link, and you can see all of our reporters, or at least supporters, are the ones who have agreed to have their names listed publicly, and some don't for reasons that are obvious. They work at companies maybe that are on the other side of the right to repair issue, and they don't want to run afoul of them. So all of these experts support the digital right to repair, and basically I set up the group to be FUDbusters. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt, it's a phrase I'm sure you're aware of, and I felt like we were, like there was going to be right to repair legislation in many states, and that what we really needed, this was pre-COVID, were people who were in those states, who were information technology or information security people, some knowledgeable about these issues, who could go in and testify at a hearing or submit written testimony and just sort of say, listen, I'm an expert in this subject, and what you're hearing from these industry people just doesn't have much basis in reality, that there are, you know, that there are cybersecurity risks around connected devices, but they're not as a result of, you know, the schematic diagrams and software and so on. And so that was sort of the idea behind the group, almost like a speakers bureau, just a way to connect information security professionals with legislators, staff, legislative staff, people who are considering these laws and who could benefit from the knowledge that they had. I have testimony here. It's a great video of Tara Wheeler testifying in Washington State, but I don't think we can get the video working. Can we get the video working, Ian?
You are now unmuted. Nope.
In IRC. That's right. It's awesome. Yeah.
You are now muted.
So this is if you just search like Tara Wheeler gangster testimony, that was Lewis Rossman, who's a big right to repair advocate and has a big Discord group focused on right to repair, runs a repair shop in Manhattan, has gone all over the country to testify at these hearings, and he caught one of our experts, Tara Wheeler, in Washington, and really liked her testimony and shared it. So it's on YouTube. It'll be in the IRC. Check it out. Gives you a sense of kind of what we do and what we're up against within these hearings, and you know, with the industry lobby in general. I don't know if you had a chance to see Kyle Wiens speak yesterday. If not, I'll just kind of give you a update on the right to repair. So with right to repair, digital right to repair, I should say, what these laws seek to do is create a legal right to fix your own stuff. And that could include, obviously, smartphones is a great example. Any kind of consumer electronic. These days, obviously, increasingly, home appliances are smart. So they're run by software, maybe internet connected, and have a big component of them that is software based. So being able to fix your dishwasher, your refrigerator, your toaster, your home router, anything that's electronic in your life that might break. If you're a farmer, obviously, that could be farm equipment. And that's really what digital right to repair is all about. You have a right to fix your own stuff, just like you have a right to replace the oil filter in your automobile. We all take that for granted, but in fact, your right today in the United States to change the oil filter in your automobile or replace, really any component of it is predicated on a legal right that exists because the voters in Massachusetts back in 2013 or 2012 passed a ballot measure that explicitly said that owners and independent repair people have a right to repair cars. Prior to that, automakers could have limited access to the diagnostic codes and diagnostic tools, software basically, that are used to fix cars. Cars these days are run by computers. In order to fix something, you need to understand what's wrong with it, and the software tells you what's wrong with it, where the error is, where the problem is. And with that information and knowledge about what parts to use, you can go in and do the repair yourself, or your independent, you know, the corner garage can do it, or the auto dealer can do it, the authorized repair person. Automakers would have liked to have only authorized repair people do it, their dealers and authorized repair providers. And then the voters in Massachusetts said, nope, you need to make that information, diagnostic information, and those tools available to owners either at a fair market price or for free, depending on what you offer them to your authorized repair people. And that is why you can continue, basically after that law passed, the automakers signed a memorandum of understanding saying we will recognize the length of Massachusetts law nationally. And so you can continue to go to an independent garage and get your car serviced after your warranties run out. And I think most of us probably do that. I like to say when I testify that if that law did not exist, and if automakers these days chose to, they could literally prevent you from changing the tire on your own car. They could embed a RF chip in the wall of the tire that needed to authenticate to the operating system of the car wirelessly when the tire was replaced. And they could mandate that you used, manufacturer-approved tires. And in fact, that a manufacturer-approved technician did the tire change and punched in a code to authenticate the tire to the car. It's pretty dystopian to think that you couldn't even change your own car tire, but the technology totally exists today to do that. The only reason that doesn't happen, again, is because there's a right to repair law that prevents that type of monopolistic ecosystem from existing. So right to repair is basically saying you as a consumer have the right to fix your own stuff. It applies not just to, there's a law for automobiles, but unfortunately everything else in our society that isn't a car is not covered by the Massachusetts law. So digital right to repair applies to a wide range of devices from consumer electronics, depending on the state, agricultural, medical, industrial equipment, the whole bit. And this is part of a broader movement that you are all probably familiar with, kind of circular economy, which is, really has a lot of traction in Europe right now, not so much in the US, but really an effort to reduce waste, to reduce environmental harm by extending the useful life of the things that we use, moving away from kind of planned obsolescence and a throwaway economy really kind of live, have a smaller footprint, as it were. And right to repair is very much a part of that. Okay. So the good news again, you might have heard some of this in Kyle's talk yesterday, but if not, I'll just update you. So this year, 2021, we have legislation pending in 25 states in the United States, right to repair legislation. That is the most ever. It follows a number of years where we've seen more and more laws come put forward each year in the states. 18, I think there were 20 last year. And it does show that there's growing momentum behind the right to repair. So that's great. You know, on the yes side are basically most consumers and also civil society groups, pro-consumer groups like PIRG, environmental groups, and the Fix-It community, most notably the group iFixit and Kyle Weens, who have been huge supporters of this. We're getting growing support from constituencies like farmers as well. We've seen some real progress in the EU with both a EU-wide law mandating that home appliances have a repair be supported for home appliances at least for 10 years. And also in France, the publication of a federal repairability index for all not all products, but a wide range of products, including smartphones and laptops, that rates how repairable they are, whether they can be disassembled easily and had parts replaced, or whether they're all glued together and use proprietary screws, some of the nonsense that we've seen from companies like Apple. Apple and Microsoft's products do not score particularly well on that repairability index. In fact, they get failing grades. And in response to that, they've been working with groups to try and change that and make more serviceable, repairable products to do better on that French rating system. That's great news. And that's the type of thing we want to see. Obviously, there's been growing media attention to right to repair as well. MSNBC did a big piece, Vice, New York Times, Washington Post, NPR. Etc. have all covered it pretty closely in recent years, which is great, growing awareness. And then some of you may have attended local Fix-It clinics or repair cafes here in the United States, or if you're in Europe, that's a growing grassroots movement. It's taken a little bit of a hit with COVID because people have not been able to gather. I started one in my community here in Belmont, Massachusetts, but my guess is once COVID is behind us, we'll see that movement really blossom again and more of these Fix-It clinics and repair cafes popping up. People can bring stuff there. You can get them fixed by your neighbors, save yourself the money of a repair, and also keep from throwing something in the landfill. The bad news, you know, here in the United States is that despite bringing legislation up in dozens of states each year, we actually haven't gotten a digital right to repair bill passed. Most of these bills are killed off in committee, often by lobbying, intense lobbying by companies like Microsoft and Apple. They will do things like threaten to pull out of big conventions if they do conventions in your state. They will threaten to, they will either throw support behind favored legislation like tax increases, or, you know, they'll do anything to kill these bills. And of course, they sick their lobbyists and flacks, their PR flacks on legislators relentlessly, trying to scare them off of right to repair legislation. So despite many bills being proposed, we have yet to get one passed. And that is our goal for this year. I think there are some states that are promising in the United States. And so cross your fingers. You know, on the other side of this, we've got millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars arrayed against digital right to repair from industry lobbies like TechNet, AHAM, the Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers, CES, Consumer Electronics Industry Group, and then Big Ag, Big Med, you know, the industry groups representing agriculture and medicine, medical devices, and so on. So there are some pretty organized opposition to this, despite broad popular support, and that's challenging. You know, unlike the automotive industry, where you have some very big and deep-pocketed interests behind repair, like the, you know, independent repair shops have their own group. You know, in the repair community, it's mostly small repair shops, family-owned businesses, and of course, consumers themselves, which is what's great about repair, but it also means that the community is relatively atomized and not doesn't have super deep pockets for lobbying and so on. So, I mean, I think it's been an ally. I think we're overcoming it, but it it has put us at a relative disadvantage to, you know, a company like Apple, which has, you know, $250 billion in cash. And legislators, by and large, are not technologists. They are easily scared off if somebody, you know, hack is kind of a four-letter word in lawmaking. So somebody can come in and make what sounds like a plausible argument about cybersecurity risk or hacking. That's often enough to you know, scare them away from a bill for a year. That is a consistent headwind, is just the lack of in-depth knowledge of how technology works, how software works, what is and isn't intellectual property, and so on. Okay, I'm going to give you the sort of SparkNotes version of the right to repair and some of the challenges that my group and others face, some of the arguments that we encounter, and kind of the pro and con. So the big one is obviously that repair of devices poses a cybersecurity risk. So these digital right to repair laws, generally, many of them are taken from the same template. And what they say is, that if you make a digital electronic device or any kind of device, home appliance, and you provide software schematics to authorized repair people, in other words, you have a business of providing repair and maintenance and support of those devices, that you need to make those available to the owner of the device as well as their agent, so an independent repair shop or professional, their neighbor who wants to do the repair, you know, whomever they choose. Apple would be a great example. The Genius Bar is where you get your Apple devices fixed. They've got a whole range of software that Genius Bar employees can use to diagnose problems, figure out what's wrong with your device, and assist in repairing it. Tell you which component is malfunctioning, what the part number is for that piece that needs to be replaced. You know, under a digital right to repair law, Apple would need to make those Genius Bar tools available to any Apple device owner, as well as independent repair shops that do work on laptops or phones and so on. It's a great example. I'm getting a little jumpy. Am I okay? Can you hear me?
Yes, hey. I can hear you.
Okay. I was like buffering a little bit there, so I want to make sure. That's true across all different types of product categories. So the biggest argument against in terms of cybersecurity is just that TechNet and lobbies representing electronics makers and so on will say, well, that information, diagnostic software, schematic diagrams, those pose a cybersecurity risk. If you provide those to just any owner, well, people could go in and hack a device and take control of it. It's basically just sort of saying that repair information poses a cybersecurity risk and that the risk outweighs the reward of being able to fix your own stuff. They've gone so far as to say to legislators, if you pass this right to repair law, your state will become a mecca for hackers. Hackers will move here to get access to the tools that they can use to then hack all of these things. They're absurd arguments, but again, if you're not that familiar with technology, it can sound plausible and scare you off. My group's argument and response to that, obviously, is that there is no real link between repair and hacking, that if the charging port on your iPhone breaks and you want to repair that port, replace that broken part, maybe water damaged with a replacement, that doesn't pose a cybersecurity risk. You only need to know what the problem is. So, what's broken, what's preventing my phone from charging, what the part is, where it goes on the logic board so that you can replace it. And then you can get your, soldering tools out and order the replacement part and fix it. And save yourself a bunch of money and prolong the useful life of your phone. Nothing in that process involves cybersecurity risk. They might say, well, if you take it to a repair shop, they can steal your data and steal your information and so on. But of course, you don't need access to the phone's operating system to replace the charging port. And if you do, that's something you're going to have to ask the owner for as well. I like to make the point that really provisioning any service from another person requires you to extend a certain level of trust to them. If you invite somebody into your house to fix your dishwasher, you know, they can bonk you over the head and steal your wallet. That's just in the nature of transactions in an economy, and anything involves trust. But often with legislators, these folks will try and talk about those things in ways that make them seem unseemly or dangerous. But in fact, they're things that we do every day, just as consumers in an economy. You know, the other point we'll make to legislators is, listen, we already have a huge cybersecurity risk, a cybersecurity problem around connected devices. We've seen botnets like Mirai that are made up purely of webcams and hacked home routers and stuff like that. And yet we have no digital right to repair. So it's sort of like you're warning people about a problem that has actually already arrived and that we're already struggling with, which is insecure internet deployed connected devices that can be compromised and used for nefarious purposes, launching denial of service attacks, sending out spam, you know, hosting malware. That problem already exists. It's because, you know, device makers do a crappy job securing their products, both in design and in deployment. And it is completely irrespective of their ability to repair that device. It all kind of boils down to there is no security in obscurity, that merely by keeping the workings of your device secret, you are not making it secure. That's pretty well established, I know, in this community and in the information security community. It's still a pretty new concept to, you know, state legislators. So it's something we find ourselves explaining to them. The second big argument on that we hear is that repair poses a physical safety risk. It's kind of absurd, but you know, you will hear a lot of talk about lithium ion batteries exploding. And in fact, if you go to one of these, often at these hearings, battery association will have send their, it's always the same guy, to talk about lithium ion batteries and how if you don't, you know, replace them properly, it can be very dangerous and so on. It makes you think like, wow, we really shouldn't be putting lithium ion batteries in anything because these things are clearly just, you know, unstable devices that are ready to blow up in everybody's face. Those are exaggerated arguments. Obviously, lithium ion batteries, while of course it is possible that they can overheat and catch fire, generally do not. And of course, you know, as I said, we let people put their cars up on jacks and crawl underneath them to replace components in the undercarriage of the car. That's a heck of a lot more dangerous than replacing a battery on your phone or your tablet. So we let people do all kinds of dangerous things with the property that they own in order to keep it working. You can't really legislate around that, or you shouldn't. You know, the other thing is that owners might do a bad job of repairing their property, you know, particularly with things like farm equipment or, you know, devices that might, you know, pose a physical risk to them. And that if they do a bad job, that somehow ultimately the OEM is going to be held legally liable. You know, our answer to that is that's not how liability works. You know, you're responsible for designing a secure and safe product. But if somebody performs a faulty repair, I don't think there's any precedent for the fact that you're going to be legally liable for that. So again, it's a scare tactics. Legislators who aren't familiar with you know, how liability works might get fooled by it, but we try and remind them that those are just scare tactics. And the final one, and this is going to be a familiar one to the people in this audience, is that repair poses a risk to their intellectual property. That by, you know, it's hard to draw a line on where they, you know, it's hard to sort of see the limit of what companies like Apple or Microsoft consider their intellectual property, but suffice it to say, they have an expansive view of what constitutes their intellectual property. Apple will often make it seem as if merely opening up an iPhone and viewing the contents of it, viewing the assembled phone, the logic board and the parts, is some grievous violation of their intellectual property, that simply by looking at how the device is put together, you could then start manufacturing them yourself. Or that, you know, the parts that they have carefully sourced and put in the phone are somehow should not be exposed to the owner of the phone, because that violates, you know, that then you're seeing how their supply chain works. It's crazy, but they'll say it as a way to imply that, you know, repairing phones is going to give owners some, you know, in-depth knowledge about Apple's source code, manufacturing processes, supply chain, and ways that will put them in a competitive disadvantage. You know, again, schematic diagrams that show you what the different parts are in a device and where, how it all fits together, are not intellectual property. In fact, not too long ago, they were pasted to the back of every refrigerator and dishwasher that was ever sold, because they knew, the manufacturers knew, at some point this owner is going to want to fix the thing, and they're going to need to know how it, you know, what the part is and where it goes. You know, this is clearly not intellectual property. It's not proprietary information. It's just a helpful diagram to help people service and maintain their device. So that's not how intellectual property works. We make that argument to legislators. iFixit has a new legislative coordinator who is helping to kind of explain that to them. But often, you know, again, if it's a plausible sounding argument, that's enough to carry the day. So that's another one that we do run up against from time to time. You know, the big risk here is what one of our secure repairs members, Richard Forno, made an argument in testimony that he submitted, and I actually have the link to it down. It's Stanford published it on their cyber law blog, which is great. But you know, the thing that we need to be concerned about is this concept of the digital company town, that as we move from an environment made mostly of, you know, mechanical devices that we use and that provide convenience in our life, to software-driven devices and Internet of Things, software-driven and internet-connected world of devices, that the manufacturers of those devices are increasingly moving towards this concept of what Richard calls the digital company town. And it's a reference, if you're not, you know, here in the United States, you know, the company towns back in the 19th century or early 20th century might be mining firms or steel manufacturers, where the workers who worked in the mine or the factory lived in homes that were owned by the company and shopped at stores that were also owned by the company. And so the company, in essence, controlled every facet of their life. You know, they paid the wages, but then got that money back in rent and groceries and other things. And they are often ways to sort of create a, it was kind of like sharecropping, you know, create a kind of serfdom for their employees, in which they got in debt to the company and they were never able to get out. You know, they weren't getting fair rent. They were paying more for their food than they would have otherwise. And it created dependency on the company. A lot of these kind of digital product ecosystems are starting to really look like that. You know, the technology vendors want to create the digital equivalent of the company town, where they and only they provide the goods and services to their customers, and deny them the right to manage, maintain, support, tinker with their own stuff. You know, as Richard points out, there are a number of problems with that. First of all, it's monopolistic behavior, and so it imposes costs on the consumer by reducing the benefit of competition for those services and parts. And the other is it creates a kind of monoculture or an ecosystem, a single point of failure and vulnerability for individuals and businesses alike. I'll point out that, you know, the Department of Justice recently charged an individual for trying to plant malware on the network of Tesla. You know, Tesla is a company that is a ardent opponent of the right to repair, and in fact, sent a letter out to all the Tesla owners in Massachusetts this past November to try and defeat a state referendum to expand our auto right to repair to include wireless telematics data, which Tesla relies on telematics, wireless telematics very heavily. That ballot measure passed overwhelmingly, which is great. But when you consider it, you know, if you were able to put ransomware on Tesla's network and gain access to the back-end systems that they use to push updates out to their fleet of hundreds of thousands or millions of deployed vehicles, you could, in essence, brick those vehicles in the driveway or in the parking lot or even on the highway while they're driving, and hold them hostage for ransom. That is a risk that comes from a, you know, this kind of technology monoculture, this top-down kind of very tightly integrated ecosystem. And that is a huge risk to our economy and to consumers, and it's something we need to consider. And in fact, it's not just, so that's one example, but in fact, this digital kind of dystopia already exists. It's already here. And if you want to see it, you just need to go to your local farm and talk to the farmer who right now is over a barrel to OEMs, manufacturers like John Deere and International Harvester, who sell $100,000, $200,000 pieces of equipment to farmers that they cannot repair and service themselves because of software-based controls and restrictions. So within the last 20 years, these manufacturers have moved, have developed an array of incredibly sensitive internet-connected farm machinery, and they're using basically digital rights management to lock down every component of those tractors and combine harvesters and other equipment so that farmers do not have the ability to do even simple repairs on their equipment without going through a Deere authorized service provider who comes out, plugs in a proprietary computer to get the error code and diagnose the problem, and then insists that the farmer install a Deere authorized part to fix the problem at whatever Deere chooses to charge for it. It is a completely hermetic ecosystem, and it is a massively expensive for farmers who already operate with very thin margins. I was at a hearing in Maryland for their right to repair law. They had a Maryland farmer there who runs, admittedly, a large-scale farm. But he said that in 2020, his bill for service and repair for his Deere equipment was $180,000 just in service and repair. And that is because there is no competition, and there is no competition because Deere software basically has created a company town. It prevents owners, operators, independents from being able to work on these devices. And when you consider also that farmers, you know, many farmers out in Montana, Nebraska, Wyoming, they may live 2 hours from a Deere dealership. So when these devices throw an error code, it's not like your car. It's not like the check engine light comes on. You're like, okay, well, I'm going to have to get my car in to be seen soon, but I'm going to keep driving on it. Maybe I'll ignore the check engine light, just keep driving on it forever and never get it checked out. With the Deere, with this agricultural equipment, when the error code happens, could be a bad sensor, could be something is wrong, the equipment goes into what's called cripple mode, and it is basically disabled, so it can move but very slowly, basically so you can get it out of the field and out of the way, but it is completely incapable of functioning anymore until the repair tech comes out to diagnose the problem, clear the error code, fix the problem if there is a problem, and there isn't always. For farmers in remote parts of the United States, that might entail a 2-hour drive by the technician out to the farm, paid for mileage plus hourly rate, and then you know, pay for their time to diagnose the problem. They may then need to go back another 2 hours to get the part, come out 2 hours again to replace it. So as you can see, it adds up to thousands of dollars, even for basic repairs. It is completely dystopian. And it's just a reality. This is a picture from a hearing on a right to repair bill in Montana, in which a farmer who's part of the Montana Farmers Bureau held up the service manual from his 1990 combine. It was the first combine he ever drove as a farmer. And you can see it's a 12-inch thick, 14-inch thick, paper-bound service manual. And he basically said, you could rebuild any part of this, of the combine harvester, with the information in this manual. John Deere and other providers do not provide that information anymore. If you access that, you have to pay multi-thousand dollar per year subscription to get access to it. And even then, you can't really do the repairs yourself because you need the technician out to unlock to authorize and diagnose the problem, get you the information you need to do the repair. So they're really over a barrel. And that's why 40-year-old tractors and combines are selling for a premium now, not because they're amazing technology, but just because you can fix them and service them and keep them going. So it's a problem that really, you know, if you look at that John Deere example, if you look at the agricultural equipment industry and the struggles they're having there where there is no right to repair, that is a model that very easily could be reproduced and replicated, you know, across our economy and every part of our life. Your dishwasher, your refrigerator, your toaster, your, you name it. So this is something we need to get on top of. What can you do next? Join the fight. So this is a great audience for us. We need people who are technically adept and who are familiar with technology to become part of our movement. We're looking for residents in states where right to repair legislation is being considered. And again, there are 25 of them this year. You can go to USPIRG.org to their right to repair site, and they'll tell you which states those are. And we're looking for people to submit written testimony, if they want to submit oral testimony on their support for right to repair, and just bring their knowledge and expertise to the conversation. Legislators like to hear from people who are their constituents. It makes a big difference. And if we can get you to show up either in writing or in person, that really helps the cause. And the other is just to spread the word. You know, right to repair is kind of an esoteric issue, I think, sometimes for people. But it is a really important issue, and it's going to be a much more important issue in the years to come, again, as more and more of our stuff is software driven. So I would urge you to, if you're listening to this presentation, to spread the word to your friends and let them know about this phenomenon. If you're interested, I do a newsletter that covers right to repair news. It's called The Fight to Repair Weekly, and it's a Substack, and you can subscribe to it. And other than that, I'm done. I can take questions, or we can wrap.
Wait, please. Paul, thank you. Yes. For your presentation. We have a couple of questions.
Sure.
First of all, Elias, you asked that I'd be curious to hear his opinion on AVs. I think this means autonomous vehicle, since those are likely to take even more control away from people.
Sure. And in fact, we're seeing in the United States and elsewhere already that there's been a string of accidents involving Teslas, which are not autonomous, but which have no hands driving features on them. Unfortunately, these Teslas keep driving under semi trucks and decapitating their drivers. So I think what I'd say on AVs is, of course, autonomous vehicles are very promising technology. I feel like regulators, both in the I don't know about the EU, but definitely in the US, are well behind the technology, and that vehicle makers like Tesla have been able to introduce and roll out autonomous or semi-autonomous features really without a proper vetting, both for their reliability and potentially for their cybersecurity as well. I think that I think the technology is great, but I think that the price of that technology for consumers, whether it's car vehicle consumers or any other consumers, can't be a monopoly. So the argument can't be, we've got this great autonomous vehicle technology, but it's really sophisticated, and we just don't think most owners are you know, adept enough to be able to even work on cars with this technology in it. So, you know, in exchange for the autonomous vehicle technology, we need to be able to control the whole repair, service, maintenance process. They're going to try and use that argument, I guarantee you. And again, no, I think there's already evidence that they're missing, that they're failing in the job to make reliable and safe software. Again, the fact that Teslas keep driving under semi-trucks is a good example. And so I think that as we start to open the door to autonomous vehicle technology, that the right to repair and transparency around the software, hardware that goes into those needs to be part and parcel of that. We can't trade one for the other. And we hear this kind of, just give us a monopoly and we'll make sure it's the best, cleanest, safest, most coolest monopoly you've ever seen. But we need the monopoly. And the answer is no. Owners have a right to fix their own property, maintain their own property, period, stop. If you can't deliver a cool feature without the monopoly, maybe you shouldn't be able to, maybe you should deliver a cool feature.
Thank you. We run out of time, but we have just one question.
Sure.
So Nupilios asked, what do you think about making codes, etc. open if a company is going out of business?
That's such a great question, and thank you for asking it. I think that is a really wonderful idea. And I think that I would love to see it formalized in law in some way. There's a huge problem with abandonware, with companies that make connected products and then say, you know what, we're not interested in supporting this product. We saw this with Sonos recently and Google as well. And then people who bought the product are basically abandoned. The product is either bricked or they can't update it anymore. So I think there should be some law that says basically if you're end of lifing, if you're deciding not to support a product anymore, that you should open source the software and allow the community of users to maintain it for you, or to continue maintaining it so that, you know, you can get the maximum useful life out of that device that you purchase, which could be measured in decades. We don't know. So I think that that's a really great question. I think it's a really important issue and one that we need to start educating lawmakers about sooner rather than later. It's part of the right to repair. It's a little bit different, but I'm totally with you on it.
Thank you so much. By the way, there is a discussion on IRC. I'm suggesting you to join and see that.
Okay, great.
Thank you for the talk. Folks, we will continue on 2:45 again.
Bye, everybody.